This is Telling Tales with Ms. G here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. And I have a story tonight from a very innovative and fun author, I think. Her name is Shay Youngblood, and this is In a House of Wooden Monkeys. I'll be right back, so stay tuned here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska with Telling Tales and Ms. G. And this is Ms. G back with Telling Tales here tonight at 104.3 in Juneau. Tonight's story is about faith by Ms. Shay Youngblood, and it's called In a House of Wooden Monkeys. Summer rain sounded heavy on the new tin roof. Loud whispers ran up and down the rough wooden pews. Father McIntyre was getting impatient. He knew Moses would not come, and he could not perform the ceremony if Moses was not there. "Yate, where is Moses? We have waited long enough," the father said. "He soon come, father. He know we waiting for he," the young woman answered, lowering her eyes to the fat brown baby she held close to her heart. She didn't seem to notice the impatience in the air, but her throat was as tight as a witch's drum, and her spine tingled with the tension. On this most important day, she and Moses had fought over the ritual to baptize the baby in holy water to protect it. Moses had raised his hand to slap her, a thing he had never done, and left before he did. She was in misery, but could not show it before all those who had come to witness. The child in Yates's arms was restless and cried. Yate carefully opened her worn white cotton blouse and offered her breast, full with milk, to the child. She guided her tender nipple into her baby's mouth. It sucked noisily. Her clear brown eyes watched, her full dark lips smiled at her baby, the most happiness she had ever had in her young life, because she got to keep this one. She had lost two babies already. Hill folks said widow took her babies. The first one widow drowned in a dream sack, told folk she dreamed Yate's baby would be born dead, and it was. The second time widow strangled her baby with the mother's string. Everyone knew widow had done it. Widow was a toothless young woman who had come to Green Love Mountain as a girl to live with her grandmother, a root woman, in a wood shack by the road. Her grandmother died shortly after she came, and as she was strange and thought to be blessed of evil, no one would take her in. So she lived high up on the mountain. She got the name Widow by the birthmark shaped like a black widow spider she carried on her forehead, and by her dark attitude and visions of death. The third time Yate discovered that there was a child growing inside of her, she began to go to Green Love Mountain Church on Sundays. The white man had come from England to teach her poor people about his God, who said he was the Almighty and All-Powerful One.
He certainly was a rich god. He allowed the priests to dress in fancy velvet robes and white satin hats to perform grand rituals with white candles set in heavy brass and drink French red wine, he called blood, from an inlaid golden chalice. Yate burned offerings at the breaking of each day and went to the church services every Sunday morning to pray to the white man's God, hoping his prayer and juju would be stronger than widow's magic this time. She prayed with a desperate passion to Jesus, and she prayed to the Virgin Mary, whom she pitied, to save her baby. Baby Jillian was born in her Mama Etta's house, arriving lungs filled with fear and clenched fists, beating the air that smelled so of blood. Yate cried, praise the Lord in her personal juju. She kissed the holy medal she wore around her neck. Moses, who laughed at her, shaking his dreadlocks from side to side at his woman's foolishness. It is Jah taking care of these women. You better forget this Jesus nonsense, he said, lighting a bowl of herb, smoke and scent of it rising in the air between them. More had come between them because of her promise to the white man's God. Moses was pleased at the birth of a living child. For 2 years they had only stolen hours. Mama Etta had kept a sharp eye on her daughter, sending her to town school, hoping to keep the young lovers apart. With the birth of baby Jillian, even Mama Etta could not hold Yate. They could live together as man and wife. Mama Etta poured rum into the earth and slit the throat of a baby goat. For as long as Yate could remember, there were babies in Mama Etta's house. Soft, fat, warm, brown babies that cried when pinched and laughed when teased in tender spots. Mama Etta was a rich woman because she would always have someone to take care of her. She had 15 children to her credit. Her sons would provide for her and carry the family name to another generation, and her daughters, when educated, would marry well and visit her often with many grandchildren to warm her lap. To Yate, these things were important, to have someone to love you always. A man could leave you. To deliver a living, growing thing from her body was a miracle she wanted to bear. She knew that Mama Etta could not keep her from her man, even though he was a Rastaman, if she were to bear his child. She loved Moses enough. She could feel it in her heart and blood and limbs whenever he watched her undress at the river or touched her body with a reverence and ritual she marveled at when they made love on mossy patches of damp earth beneath the coolness of the waterfall. Yate promised Jesus she would go up the hill to the white man's church every day if her baby was allowed to be among the living, and so she did. When baby Jillian was born alive and kicking, Yate invited all her friends and family, many of whom had never been to church, to come see her baby be blessed with holy water. Some came only for the spectacle, as they were suspicious of a man with only one God. St. Julian came because she was Yate's best girlfriend. They were friends and lovers long before she met Moses. St. Julian's husband was at sea for many months of the year. It was only natural that she longed for hands and lips of passion on her breast and on the soft spot between her thighs, and warm arms to hold her through the endless nights her husband was away. So many men of the village loved the sea. She also could not have a baby by Yate to anger her husband. She often wished that many things were not as they were, but when the men returned from the sea, the women turned from each other in that intimate way, back to their men. It had always been the way from her grandmother's time and before. The faithful of the congregation were waiting, hands pressed in respect for the ritual. This was to be the first christening in the church. Four families were present with new babies to be sprinkled with the priest's holy water. Father McIntyre blew his nose into a white lace handkerchief and cleared his throat, as he did when he was about to speak on some important subject in his Sunday morning talks to them. "I can wait no longer. Let us begin," the father said. "But my Jillian, will you bless her?" Yate whispered. tears reaching for the edge of her eyes. The father turned away from her tears and to those who had come for the ceremony. He was so cold, his words chilled like ice. A man who would allow his child to be punished for his sins is not a man. If a woman is loose and without moral responsibility, she is the devil's sin, and so is her child. In good conscience, I cannot perform the rites for Yates' bastard child. Angry looks flew above the injustice of his words. Up to this point, there had been silence. But Mama Etta spilled herself into the room and stepped like a queen up to the altar to her daughter's side. She is a daughter of the gods and loved not less. She ain't belonging to no Rasta man, to no devil, no other woman, just me. I give her life and breath from between these thighs, something you can never do, because it is you who are evil and cannot bear a miracle. You are a no-feeling wooden monkey, and so are the people of this house. She spit in the dust before him. Taking her daughter's arm, they made their way down the aisle and through the doors of the church. Father McIntyre stood stiffly before the podium and watched helplessly as the pews emptied behind Mama Etta, Yate, and baby Jillian. The silent procession of those who had lost faith wound down the dirt path to the village. Widow stood grinning in the doorway after most all had gone but the father. She said a few words that made no sense to human ears, shook some feathers, then squat to pee on the threshold. The remaining of the congregation watched in surprise as the father seized his throat and choked himself to the ground, where he wallowed like a dog. Widow watched him some, then turned to follow the others. That was Shay Youngblood in A House of Wooden Monkeys. You're listening to Telling Tales with Ms. G here at KTO 104.3 FM. I'll be right back. Hello there, this is Ms. G, back with more at Telling Tales here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. I hope you enjoyed that last story. It was by Ms. Shay Youngblood, called In a House Full of Wooden Monkeys. And this next story is by Andrea Lee. It's titled Mother. In the summer, my mother got up just after sunrise, so that when she called Matthew and me for breakfast, the house was filled with sounds and smells of her industrious mornings. Odors of frying scrapple or codfish, cakes drifted up the back stairs, mingling sometimes with the sharp scent of mustard greens she was cooking for dinner that night. Up the laundry chute from the cellar floated whiffs of steamy air and the churning sound of the washing machine. From the dining room, where she liked to sit ironing and chatting on the telephone, came the fragrance of hot, clean clothes and the sound of her voice. Cheerful, resonant, reverberating a little weirdly through the high-ceilinged rooms as if she were sitting happily at the bottom of a well. My father left early in the morning to visit parishioners or to attend church board meetings. Once the door had closed behind him, the house entered what I thought of it as a natural state, that of the place on earth that most purely reflected my mother. It was a big suburban house, handsomer than most, built of field stone in a common, vaguely Georgian design. It was set among really magnificent azaleas in a garden whose too small size gave the house a faintly incongruous look, like a dowager in a short skirt. The house seemed little different from any other in my neighborhood, but to me, in my early acquired role as a detective, a spy, a snooper into dark corners, there were about it undeniable hints of mystery. The many closets had crooked shapes that suggested secret passages in the basement, the walls of the wine cellar, its racks filled by our teetotaling family with old galoshes and rusty roller skates, gave a suspicious hollow sound when rapped, and on the front doorbell, almost obliterated by the pressure of many fingers, was printed a small crescent moon. The house stayed cool on breathless summer days when tar oozed in the streets outside, the heat excluded by thick walls and drawn shades, and the dim rooms animated by a spirit of order and abundance. When I came dawdling down to breakfast long after Matthew had eaten and gone plunging off in his balloon-tired Schwinn, I usually found my mother busy in the kitchen, perhaps shelling peas or stringing beans or peeling a basket of peaches for preserves. She would fix me with her lively, sarcastic dark eyes and say, "Here comes Miss Sarah, the cow's tail. What, pray tell, were you doing all that time upstairs?" "Getting dressed." What I'd been doing, in fact, what I did every summer morning, was reading, lounging voluptuously in my underpants on the cool, bare expanse of my bed, while flies banged against the screen and greenish sunlight glowed through the shades. I would read with a kind of ferocious appetite that belongs only to garden shrews, bookish children, and other small creatures who need double their weight in nourishment daily. With impartial gluttony, I plunge into fairy tales, adult novels, murder mysteries, poetry, and magazines when my mother moved about downstairs. The sense of her presence, of even a sort of tacit complicity, was always a background at these chaotic feasts of the imagination. "You were reading," Mama would say calmly when I stood before her in the kitchen. "You must learn not to tell obvious lies. Did you make up your bed?" "I forgot." "Well, you're not going outside until you've done something to that room of yours. It looks like a hoorah's nest. Your place is set at the table, and the cantaloupe is over there. We've had such delicious cantaloupe this week. Scrape out the seeds and cut yourself a slice." "No, wait a minute. Come here. I want to show you how to cut up a chicken." Each time she did this, I would wail with disgust, but I had to watch. The chicken was a pimply yellow-white with purplish shadows and a cavernous front opening. My mother would set her big knife to it, baring her teeth in an ogress's grin that made fun of my squeamishness. "You saw along the backbone like this. Watch carefully. It takes a strong arm, and then you crack the whole thing open." In her hands, the cave would burst apart, exposing its secrets to the light of day, and with another few strokes of the knife would be transformed into ordinary meat, our uncooked dinner. It was easy for me to think of my mother in connection with caves, with anything in the world, in fact, that was dimly lit and fantastic. Sometimes she would rivet Matthew and me with a tale from her childhood, how at 9 years old, walking home through the cobblestone streets of Philadelphia with a package of ice cream from the drugstore, she had slipped and fallen down a storm drain accidentally left uncovered by workmen. No one was around to help her. She dropped the ice cream she was carrying, something that made a deep impression on my brother and me, and managed to cling to the edge and hoist herself out of the hole. The image of the little girl who was to become my mother hanging in perilous darkness was one that haunted me. Sometimes it showed up in my dreams. Perhaps her near-fatal tumble underground was responsible for my mother's lasting attraction to the bizarre side of life. Beneath a sometimes prudish exterior, she quivered with excitement in the same way her children did over newspaper accounts of trunk murders, foreign earthquakes, Siamese twins, mafia graves in the New Jersey Pine Barrens. When she commented on these subjects, she attempted a firm neutrality of tone, but gave herself away in the heightened pitch of her voice and in a little breathy catch that broke the rhythm of each sentence she spoke. This was the voice she used to whisper shattering bits of gossip over the phone. "When Mr. Tillett died," I heard her say once with that telltale intake of breath, "the funeral parlor did such a poor job that his daughter had to wire her own father together." My mother, Grace Renfrew Phillips, had been brought up with all the fussy little airs and graces of middle-class colored girls born around the time of World War I. There was about her an endearing air of a provincial maiden striving for sophistication, a sweet affectation of culture that reminded me, when I was older, of Emma Bovary. She and her cluster of pretty, light-skinned sisters grew up in a red brick house with marble steps in South Philadelphia. They all played the piano, knew a bit of French and yards of Wordsworth, and expected to become social workers, elementary school teachers, or simply good wives to suitable young men from their own background. Sober young doctors, clergymen, and postal administrators. Not too dark of complexion. Gracie Renfrew fit the pattern, but at the same time dismayed her family by attending Communist Party meetings, joining a theater group, and going off to a Quaker work camp. When she married my father, the prescribed young minister, my mother had become, inevitably, a schoolteacher. A beautiful one. She was full-faced, full-bodied, with an indestructible olive skin and an extraordinary forehead, high with two handsome hollows over the temples. She had a bright, perverse gaze, accentuated by a slight squint in her left eye and a quite unusual physical strength. She swam miles every summer at the swim club and at the small Quaker school where I was a student, and she taught sixth grade. It was common to see her jumping rope with the girls, her large bosom bobbing and a triumphant, rather disdainful smile on her face. Her pupils adored her, probably because her nature held a touch of the barbarism that all children admire. She would quell misbehavior, for instance, by threatening in a soft, convincing voice to pull off the erring student's ears and fry them for supper. At home, Mama was a housekeeper in the grand old style that disdains convenience, worships thrift, and condones extravagance only in the form of massive Sunday dinners, which, like acts of God, leave family members stunned and reeling. Her kitchen, a long, dark, inconvenient room, joined to a crooked pantry, was entirely unlike the cheerful kitchens I saw on television, where mothers who looked like June Cleaver unwrapped food done up in cellophane. This kitchen had more of the feeling of a workshop, a laboratory in which the imperfect riches of nature were investigated and finally transformed into something near sublimity. The sink and stove were cluttered with works in progress. Hot plum jelly dripping into a bowl through cheesecloth, chocolate syrup bubbling in a saucepan, string beans and ham bones hissing in the pressure cooker, cooling rice puddings flavored with almond and vanilla, cooked apples waiting to be forced through a sieve to make applesauce, in a vat, a brownish aromatic mix for root beer. The instruments my mother used were a motley assemblage of blackened cast iron pots, rusty-handled beaters, graters, strainers, and an array of mixing bowls that included the cheapest plastic variety, as well as tall, archaic-looking stoneware tubs inherited from my grandmother, who had herself been a legendary cook. Mama guarded these ugly tools with jealous solicitude, suspicious of any new introductions. and she moved in her kitchen with the modest agility of a master craftsman. Like any genuine passion, her love of food embraced every aspect of the subject. She read cookbooks like novels and made a business-like note in her appointment book of the date that Wanamaker's received its yearly shipment of chocolate-covered strawberries. Matthew and I learned from her a sort of culinary history of her side of the family. Our grandfather, for instance, always asked for calf brain scrambled with his eggs on weekend mornings before he went out hunting. Grandma Renfrew, a sharp-tongued beauty from North Carolina, loved to drink clabbered milk and was so insistent about the purity of food that once when Aunt Lily had served her margarine instead of butter, she had refused to eat at Lily's table again for a year. My mother's sole memory of her mother's mother, a Maharan Indian called Molly, was of the withered, dark-faced woman scraping an apple in the corner of the kitchen and sucking the pulp between her toothless jaws. Mama took most pleasure in the raw materials that became meals. She enjoyed the symmetry, the unalterable rules, and also the freaks and vagaries that nature brought to her kitchen. She showed me with equal pleasure the handsome shape of a fish backbone, the little green gallbladder in the middle of a chicken liver, and the double-yolked eggs, the triple cherries, the peculiar worm in a cob of corn. As she enjoyed most of the follies, the bizarre twists of human nature and experience, so also she had a peculiar fondness for the odd organs and connective tissues that others disdained. "Gristle is delectable," she would exclaim as Matthew and I groaned. "The best part of the cow." I was rather lazy and dunderheaded apprentice to my mother. She could be snappish and tyrannical, but I hung around the kitchen anyway in a quest of scrapings of batter and because I liked to listen to her. She loved words, not as my father the minister did, for their ceremonial qualities, but with an offhanded playfulness that resulted in a combination of wit and nonsense. In her mischievous brain, the broad country imagery of her Virginia-bred mother mingled with the remains of a ladylike education that had classical pretensions. When she was annoyed at Matthew and me, we were pestilential pestaloses. We were also from time to time as deaf as adders, as dumb as oysters, as woolly as sheep's backs. We occasionally thrashed around like horses with the colic. At odd moments, she addressed recitations to the family cat, whom she disliked. Her favorite selections were versions of "O Captain, My Captain," "O Cat, My Cat, Our Fearful Trip Is Done," and Cicero's address in Catiline, "How long, cat, will you abuse our patience?" On summer mornings, after the dinner dishes had been washed and as the remains of the iced tea stood growing tepid in the pitcher, my mother, dreamy and disheveled, finally would emerge from the kitchen. "Look at me," she'd murmur, wandering into the living room and patting her hair in the mirror over the piano. "I look like a wild man of Borneo." She would change into a pair of Oxfords and take a walk with me, or with a neighbor. At the time of day, June bugs hurled themselves against the screens of the house, and my father, covered with mosquito repellent and smoking cigarette after cigarette, sat reading under the maple tree. In the diffused light after sunset, the shadows around the perfectly ordinary houses up and down the street made the unambitious details of their designs, turrets, round Victorian towers, vague, half-timbering, seemed for once dramatic. All the backyards of the town seemed to have melted into one darkening common where packs of kids yelled faintly and fought their last battles before bedtime. Cars pulled out of driveways and headed for movie theaters or the shopping centers along the pike, and the air smelled like honeysuckle and onion grass. When Mama and I walked together, we would wander up and down the long blocks until the streetlights came on. One evening during the summer that I was 6 years old, we stopped to visit a neighboring family in which something sad and shocking had happened the previous winter. The father, a district judge named Roland Barber, had driven one gray afternoon to the marshland outside the airport and there had shot himself. Judge Barber, a short, grave, brown-skinned man with a curiously muted voice, had been a member of my father's congregation and had served with him on the board of the NAACP. His suicide with hints of further reaching scandal sent a tremendous shock through the staid circles of my parents' friends, a shock that reached down even into the deep waters that normally insulated Matthew and me from adult life. For a few weeks after the suicide, we held long, grisly discussions on arcane, even acrobatic ways to do away with oneself. The house in which Mrs. Barber continued to live with her teenage daughter was little different from our house or any other in our neighborhood. A brick colonial with myrtle and ivy planted around it instead of grass, and a long backyard that sloped down to a vegetable garden. I knew the Barber's yard well because there was an oak tree near the vegetable garden with a swing in it that neighborhood kids were all allowed to use. On the evening my mother and I came to visit, the daylight was fading and the windows of the house were dark. It seemed that no one was home. But in the summers in our town, people often waited a long time in the evening before turning on lamps. It occurred to me as we walked up the driveway that the house itself seemed to be in mourning, with its melancholy row of blue spruces by the fence. I gave way, with a feeling that was almost like ecstasy, to a sudden shudder. Mama rubbed my goose pimply arms. "We'll just stay a minute," she said. My mother was carrying a recipe for peach cobbler. It was intended for Mrs. Barber, a bony woman who had fascinated me even before her husband's death, because she wore a very thick pair of elasticized stockings. However, after we'd knocked and waited for a while, the front door was finally opened by Phyllis, the barber's 16-year-old daughter. Mama, who had taught Phyllis, sometimes referred to her as the fair and brainless. I had seen her plenty of times at the swim club, pretty and somewhat fat-faced, drawing the stares of the men to her plump legs in Bermuda shorts. That night, though it was only about 8 o'clock, she opened the door in a light summer bathrobe and peered out at us without turning on the porch lights. "Hello, Mrs. Phillips. Hi, Sarah," she said in a low, hesitant voice. She came out onto the dark steps as she spoke and let the screen door bang behind her. She explained that her mother wasn't there and that she had been taking a shower when the bell rang. She radiated a fresh scent of soap and shampoo. When my mother asked her how she was feeling, she answered in the same hesitant tone, "All right." I looked at her with a kind of awe. It was the first time I had seen her since I had heard the news about Judge Barber, and the first time I had ever stood right in front of someone associated with an event that had caused such a convulsion in the adult world. In the light-colored robe with her wet hair, which normally she wore flipped up at the ends and pulled back with a band, like other high school girls in the neighborhood, combed back from her forehead, she had a mysterious, imposing look that I never would have suspected of her. I immediately ascribed it as I was describing the ordinary shadow of the summer and twilight around the doorway to the extraordinary thing that had happened to her. Her face seemed indefinably swollen, weathered with tears or temper, and she kept her top lip tightly clenched as she talked to my mother. She looked beautiful to me, like a dream or an illustration from a book, and as I stared at her, I felt intensely interested and agitated. In a few minutes, Phyllis went back inside. My mother and I, as we had done many times before, walked quietly up the barber's driveway and through the backyard to the swing in the oak tree. Mama stopped to pick a few tomatoes from the overloaded plants in the barber's vegetable garden, and I helped her, though my second tomato was a rotten one that squashed in my fingers. It was completely dark by then. Lightning bugs flashed their cold green semaphores across the backyards of the neighborhood, and a near tropical din of rasping, creaking, buzzing night insects had broken out in the trees around us. I walked over and sat down in the oak tree, and Mama, pausing occasionally to slap mosquitoes, gave me a few good pushes so that I flew high out of the leaves toward the night air. I couldn't see her, but I felt her hands against my back. That was enough. There are moments when the sympathy between mother and child becomes again almost what it was at the very first. At that instant, I could discern in my mother, as clearly as if she had told me of it, the same almost romantic agitation that I felt. It was an excitement rooted in her fascination with grotesque antidotes, but it went beyond that. While my mother pushed me in the swing, it seemed as if we were conducting, without words, a troubling yet oddly exhilarating dialogue about pain and loss. In a few minutes, I dragged my sneakered feet in a patch of dust to stop the swing. The light of a television had gone on inside the barber house, and I imagined fat, pretty Phyllis Barber carefully rolling her hair on curlers, alone in front of the screen. I grabbed my mother's hand and said, "It's very sad, isn't it?" "It certainly is," said Mama. We took a shortcut home, and by the time we got there, it was time for me to scrub my grimy arms and legs and to go to bed. Mama went immediately to the refrigerator and got out an uncooked roast of pork, which she stood contemplating as if it were the clue to something. She smelled of sage and dried mustard when she came upstairs to kiss Matthew and me goodnight. You've just heard me read Andrea Lee's Mother. I hope you enjoyed tonight's show, Telling Tales with Ms. G. And until next time, take care. I'll now start new letters on the air in progress. Good night.